Your great-grandfather was John D. Rockefeller, who created the powerful Standard Oil Company of the late 1800s. Place yourself in the next generations of your family that came after him.
He had a son, John D. Rockefeller Jr., who devoted his life to giving away much of the money that his father had made. And then his children, he had six children, the youngest of whom was my father, David Rockefeller. And there were 22 first cousins out of the first litters. And there were two more after me, but I was the youngest of the first wave of cousins. And I'm the youngest woman of the cousins' generation.
And you grew up in New York and in Maine, and then you lived in California after you got married.
Yes.
How did you come to Vermont?
Well, first, because I came to Middlebury College and had a wonderful 4 years there. And I wanted to return to New England after having gone to a wonderful boarding school, seventh and eighth grade, across Lake Champlain, near Lake Placid, called North Country School. So I was determined once I finished out boarding school in Maryland that I was coming back north and Vermont was it. And then after I graduated, about 4 years later, I returned looking for a weaving studio, which I found at Shelburne Farms, which then was only just beginning their programs. And while I was there to do weaving, I kept hearing about these educational programs starting. And before long, I just couldn't contain myself. And I helped to start the education programs with the woman they'd hired. Then the following year, I became their first director of development and communications. So that's really how I got to Vermont. While working at Shelburne Farms, I met what was to become my husband of now 33 years, Paul Growald. And yet he was living in San Francisco, asked me to move out there. I moved there on Halloween, which is probably the best possible day to ever move to San Francisco because it's one huge party. So it was just wonderful. We spent 17 years there, and amazingly, we've now been back here full-time 17 years.
Your family's name is filled with history and politics and extreme wealth and philanthropy. And your feelings about being a Rockefeller at different points in your life seem to range from extreme self-consciousness to gratitude to ambivalence at points. And I'd love to hear you reflect on what kind of responsibility you felt being a Rockefeller.
Well, I think one way to sum it up is if you go to Rockefeller Center and you look at my grandfather's credo, engraved in stone is part of the credo that I remember and have always remembered is every opportunity implies an obligation, every possession a duty, every right a responsibility. And that's a heavy mantle. And the fact that it was carved in stone at Rockefeller Center, my parents didn't really need to say that as a mantra. We all kind of found our way there and went, ugh, so what am I going to do that's going to live up to a life of philanthropy with far more money than the next generation has? How can I make a difference? But isn't that everyone's quest in life? No matter what family you come from, we all seek to find ourselves and to become ourselves. So I did go through a period early on of hiding from my name, trying to be normal. My mother had grown up in a middle-class background, and from her middle-class background, she had said to us, as a Rockefeller, you get double praise or double blame. So be sure you choose correctly. And oh, so going to school, we were driven in a chauffeured limousine. We would hop out two blocks before and nonchalantly walk to school like everyone else, in quotations. The effort to be like everyone else is again a universal. It's about belonging. And everybody wants to belong. So if you're too far to the left or the right, or you're too showy, too opulent, too whatever, it's a challenge to belong. In my 20s, I tried changing my name to McGrath, which was my middle name, my mother's name. And that worked fine for a while. They probably had already known. And that was the problem, is if you go incognito, then you never know. Who knows my name? And really, that doesn't matter. I just want them to know me. So I kicked the McGrath name out, much to my father's pleasure, because he preferred I have the name I was given. And so little by little, I guess really the writing of this book was about self-healing and about becoming myself.
You mentioned your mother just now, and she seemed like a force of nature.
You can say that again.
And interestingly, she married into the Rockefeller family, but I got the impression from reading your book that she was also really kind of the standard bearer of making sure your generation, her children, upheld the Rockefeller tradition and expectations.
I think that's true. She cared desperately that we upheld a standard, whether that was the Rockefeller standard or her own standard, or it simply happened to mesh with my father's. She cared deeply, as does my father, who's 99 and still driving a pair of horses. She cared deeply that we never assume anything from others, and that we treat a taxi driver or a hotel house cleaner the same as we would treat a king or a head of state. And I really admire that quality in my parents. You know, to this day, it doesn't matter who my father meets. He always extends his hand and says, "Hello, I'm David Rockefeller. So nice to meet you." And he means it.
You are the youngest of six siblings. Mm-hmm. And you kind of grew up with some sharp feelings of being an outsider among your siblings. Describe how that shaped how you developed as a person.
Mm. It has shaped me very much so. I think, as is true for all of us, the places in which we struggle most as children can, if we use them as opportunities, turn into our purpose in life later on, or the strengths that we bring to bear. So in my case, the four in the middle of this group of six were the real clan. They were on the inside. So the four of them were very much together. They played together. I didn't actually get to practice as much the skills of nuance and of how to fit in, because I wasn't in. What that did was to drive me toward connection wherever I could make it. And what I discovered was that if I was willing to share a story that was personal and where I rendered myself vulnerable, 9 times out of 10, the person I was speaking to, whether they were the maid working in the house or a head of state I happened to be sitting next to at a dinner party of my parents, if I shared my soul, they would share theirs. And this was so thrilling to me. And actually, it was more than thrilling. It was essential for me to feel I belonged somewhere. And so that's what has driven me to the fields of social and emotional learning, of mind-body healing, and to connecting to people through my book, which has been one of the richest experiences of my life.
We're talking with Eileen Rockefeller. Her memoir is Being a Rockefeller, Becoming Myself. What do you suppose it was that initially attracted you to the entire field of emotional literacy, as you called it then, or what's been come to be known as emotional intelligence?
Well, it goes back to the feeling of being excluded in my family. And, you know, I really hold no blame to my siblings today. We get along so well. We've worked so hard to get along. But as to why I'm interested in emotional intelligence, emotions were not allowed growing up in the 50s. You weren't supposed to express them. But I watched each of my siblings try a different technique, whether it was withdrawal, or sulking, or anger, or intellectual isolation, any number of techniques, and none of them really seem to get what they needed with regards to my mother's or father's attention. So I chose being emotional. And it's not so much that it got more attention. I guess it did get more attention, actually, than what my siblings got. It got a different kind of attention. It wasn't really what I needed, but it helped me to survive. And it kept me close to my mother. I took care of her needs growing up. She was severely depressed at times, and my job seemed to be the caregiver. And that developed emotional skills. I had to develop real intuition, because if she walked in the door and I hadn't gotten it, that she was in a really black cloud mood, I would be asking for something. And I wanted to avoid that. So in a strange, ironic way, her depression and propensity for anger or outbursts and my siblings sort of ignoring me or pushing me away helped to hone my own emotional skills.
We've talked about your mind-body work and also your work on emotional intelligence, but conservation is a theme that is present in your life from the very beginning. And you tell a story in the book about being a teenager and first having an experience with environmentalism and conservation when you became aware of pollution in the Hudson River.
Yes.
And being who you were, you had the opportunity to ask your uncle, the governor, to come down and take a look at the pollution in the river and do something about it.
Yeah.
But talk about how conservation really grew into a life's passion for you.
Well, there's an underlying theme to conservation, and I think that's the appreciation of beauty, whether it's natural or human-made. And the appreciation of beauty has probably been the greatest unifier in my family of origin and in my extended family. It runs throughout all of us.
You've become very interested in the topic of global warming.
Yes.
And that might strike some people as seeming ironic, given your family's early history running an oil company that was very powerful. Talk a little bit about how you see that juxtaposition.
Well, again, it's all about balance. In 2007, my husband and I decided to combine our philanthropy. We spent 6 months investigating all of the dreams we'd ever had. How could we make a difference in the world? And with a relatively small amount of money, what could we do that could actually make a difference? Ultimately, it came down to, no matter what we chose, everything hinged on whether or not we're going to have a climate that we can actually live healthily in. So what is impinging on that healthy climate? CO2 emissions. And what is the greatest culprit of all CO2 emissions? 40% of all CO2 is generated from coal. There were, at that point, in 2007, 200 new proposed coal-fired power plants. Each one of those would last 50 years. Each one of those would put out into the atmosphere the equivalent of 100,000 new cars. So our job was, we decided, would be to try to stop them from ever being built. That's where we could find leverage. It was a venture capital model, in a way, venture philanthropy. Simultaneous to our interest, we discovered that the Sierra Club was eager to start their Beyond Coal campaign, but they had not been successful in their fundraising efforts. So we gave them their first major grant of $150,000. That was a big grant for us. We were the catalytic grant, but others came in after us. And we also insisted that they create a business plan. We wanted to have measurable results. It wasn't just enough to create a feel-good grant. Well, to make a long story short, 172 of those 200 proposed coal plants have been stopped, will never be created. And the others are rapidly falling by the wayside. And in addition to that, where there was no funding going to stop coal back in those days, there's $90 million going to stop coal in this country now. And it's going into the existing plants and the export terminals as well. So it's a pretty exciting story.
Your grandfather set your family on a course of putting philanthropy at the center of the work your family does. How has that lived on through generations?
It's lived on through the generations as a common value. But my cousin's generation has learned to create philanthropic collaboratives, because where we couldn't fund something like start the University of Chicago or found Rockefeller University or repair Versailles or even give the money for a whole national park, what we could do was we could work together and we could preserve maybe a smaller piece of land, or we could create an organization to develop collaborative thinking. So my generation has done collaborative philanthropy, and I'm watching our sons now and their generation, and they have such creative ways of thinking about philanthropy, and they're thinking about it much more in terms of venture philanthropy, the way we're doing Grow Old Family Fund. I think we're going to see a shift from having to just earn income year in and year out by fundraising. I think that nonprofits are going to have an income-producing arm to them in order to survive. There's too much competition out there, because everybody in the world who has an interest in creating change wants to start their own organization. And 9 times out of 10, they don't check to see whether there already are 5 other organizations doing that, but they're sure they can do it better. And so they're competing for the same money. So my children's generation are looking for more innovative and business-based models to implant into the philanthropic field.
Eileen, what do you hope people will take away from reading your memoir?
What I hope they'll take away from it is that the amount of money you have, while we all need a certain amount of money to have a roof over our heads and have enough food, that the real richness of life comes in our relationships with each other and in the capacity to become ourselves as fully as possible. I think it's in becoming ourselves that we discover true meaning in our lives. And if we've discovered meaning, we have really happy, satisfied lives. And it matters far less whether we've become famous or rich, but the richness lies within.
I want to thank you so much for sharing so freely of your personal history with us. I appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. Thank you for asking such great questions.